This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This book presentation, Between the Creeks, My Saponi Adventures, by Roy A. Cooper, Jr., is made in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. We pick up the story in Chapter 3, where a nighttime snowfall has interrupted the plans for young Roy getting off to school. His daddy has said, "Well, it snowed last night. There's this big snow on the ground. I bet it's at least 4 inches. I jumped up and down and yelled gleefully, "What's wrong with that?" He retorted, "Well, I don't know how I'll get you to the school bus stop. I know that the school won't be closed because I hear traffic on the highway and the scrapers have cleared the road. But my old truck will never make it down the path." "Well, then, I can just stay at home today," I beamed. "No, you can't. You're going to school, somehow." Mother came in about that time. "Roy, you'll just have to carry him on your back." Kelly had just come in the kitchen, bringing in an armful of wood for the kitchen stove, and overheard the conversation. He stuck his head in the door and said, "Miss Lois, I can take him on the mule." Well, that was that. The next thing I knew, I was dressed and out the door. Kelly was waiting for me at the edge of the yard. He had already bridled old Mary, who was busy scratching the snow in search of grass. There was no saddle, therefore no stirrups to put my foot in to climb on her back. That did not pose a problem for Kelly. He grabbed me and hoisted me up on Mary's back, climbing up behind me, and we were off. I was grumbling because I did not want to go to sit in a schoolroom when I could play all day in the snow. Kelly reminded me, "You're a lucky boy to have parents who want you to go to school and make something of yourself." As we neared the bus stop, I said, "Kelly, let me down." "Why?" "I don't want anybody laughing at me." "If they laugh, it's just because they wish they could ride a mule to meet the school bus." But after my furious protests, he let me down, and I trudged on toward the bus stop, sloshing through the snow. The last thing I heard from Kelly was, "You're going to get your feet wet. You just see." Well, he was right. Friendship survives time. How was I to know, and I doubt that Kelly knew, that this mule ride in the snow to the school bus stop and our life at the Cobb place would always be remembered by both of us, and that our friendship would last until we passed from this earth? I know, because he stayed in touch with me. Much later, in 1945, he wrote me from his army post while I was at Wake Forest College. I answered, telling him about college life. After we stopped corresponding, I thought I would never hear from him again. But in 1959, we were living on Cross Street in Nashville, I heard a knock at the door. I opened it, and to my surprise, there stood Kelly. He was dressed to the nines in a black overcoat, a dark suit, and a black derby hat cocked to one side. He let out a big laugh, showing those beautiful white teeth, and yelled out, "Give me some ham!" His hair was white, but about 55 years, he was still muscular and as handsome as ever. He told me he was married and working at a shipyard in Norfolk, Virginia. "When I came into Nashville," he recounted, "I asked a man on the street, 'Where does Tommy Cooper live?'" "You mean Lawyer Cooper?" he asked me. "I ain't looking for no lawyer," I said. "Well, I don't know any other Tommy Cooper," he told me. "So here I am. How about that? You're a big-shot lawyer," he grinned. "Kelly," I responded, "you know I'm no big-shot, just a country lawyer." "That's the best kind," he exclaimed. We reminisced about our life at the Cobb place and laughed about the mule ride in the snow. I'm sorry that I never saw or heard from him again. I don't know if or when Kelly died, but how he lived and what he meant to me will always be fresh in my memory. Vanilla. My year at the Cobb place was about to end. The tenant at the home place was not farming to suit Daddy, so he and Mother decided to move once more. That meant that I was to leave Nashville School and enter second grade at Dean's, a two-room school located near the home place. Daddy was upset about that, for he knew, and he was right, that Nashville School was much better for me. In the years of the Depression, however, some tough choices had to be made. I was happy because I would be with my old playmates, but I was a little sad to leave my many new friends at Nashville. One day, just before school was out for the summer, Daddy would not move until I had finished the school year. Daddy picked me up from school in his old truck. When I opened the door to get in, I saw a tiny nose sticking out of his coat pocket. As I looked closer, a little head popped out. Daddy smiled, ran his head down his pocket, and pulled out a tiny white puppy. "She's yours," he said. I was dumbfounded. That was the cutest puppy I'd ever seen. I blurted out, "Where did you get her?" "Charlie Ward," he said, "and this puppy's name is Vanilla." "Why Vanilla?" "Well, Charlie said it seemed like every time he sees you, you've got a cone of vanilla ice cream in your hand. He also said his little daughter Lillian talks about you all the time, and she wanted you to have the puppy." That was news to me, but I was mighty happy about the puppy. Later in high school, I did date Lillian Ward, until I noticed a little seventh-grade girl with long black hair. Her name was Beverly, and Lillian was no match for her. No contest. Home again. In any case, Vanilla became my friend and eased the transition from the car place back to the home place. Daddy was already setting out tobacco there, and as soon as the school year ended, we made the transition, not back to the house on Evans Road, but to the little four-room house up the hill ditches from the old Bailey Highway, where we would live for the rest of my young country life. Both houses were located on the farm called the Home Place. Before the meager household furnishings were unloaded, Alan, Brother, Dewey Lee, and Thurston came walking up. The neighborhood grapevine had spread the news of our return. Everyone helped unload the truck. Then Daddy called to Mother, who was inside busily arranging her new home. "Lois, I'm going to get some help to move the stove." That was the only furniture we owned that needed more than two people to move it. Alan, Dewey, Lee, Brother, Thurston, and I jumped in the back of the truck to catch a ride as far as Uncle Dewey's house. I was home again. 6 miles doesn't seem like much to today's mobile society, but to this 6-year-old country boy who had never been to Washington or the beach or even Raleigh, it was huge. My year at the Cobb place, 6 miles away from my boyhood friends, was potential disaster. Instead, this time enriched my life. From Mother and her homeless breakfast guest, I learned the meaning of hospitality. From Daddy, I learned the importance of a good education even before I started first grade. Kelly showed me that among friends, skin color really doesn't matter. And of course, I guess the most important lesson is, in the end, there's no place like home. Chapter 4, The Honey Tree. My grandfather on Daddy's side, Pa Fed, that's James Farrell Cooper, and my grandmother, Mama Lucy, Lucy J. Baines Cooper, lived less than half a mile from my house on a narrow little dirt road, now Old Bailey Highway, State Road 1001. Even though I was only 7 years old, I could walk to their house. On these walks, Mother and Daddy never worried about my safety, for the danger of being hit by a car in those days was unheard of. A car hardly ever passed, and if it did, it rarely exceeded 35 miles an hour. On this particular day, I jumped out of bed, ran to the kitchen, and gobbled down my breakfast of scrambled eggs, sausage, good hot biscuits, and red-eyed gravy, and yelled, "Goodbye!" I vaguely heard my dad ask, "Where's he going in such an all-fired hurry?" My mother sighed, to your father's house, or Dewey's, where he'll probably meet Dewey Lee and brother and the other children. And she was right. Uncle Dewey, Daddy's brother, lived on Pa Fed's farm in a house that was only a stone's throw from Pa Fed's house. Uncle Dewey had 7 children, quite a contrast to my home situation. This was usually the meeting place where I would rendezvous with Dewey Lee and brother, whose real name was James McLean Cooper. Everyone called him brother, I guess. It was because his brothers and sisters called him that. I jumped off the porch, surprising and frightening the chickens. They were scratching around in the front yard, and my sudden jump caused them to fly in every direction, screeching their protest as I headed down the Old Bailey Highway, down the flower-covered hill ditches that protected the path from erosion. Since my house was at the end of the path, I ran past the homes of Mr. Van, Uncle Bob, Uncle Brad, and Aunt Pat. I stopped occasionally to avoid a bumblebee or dig my heels in the 2 track ruts made by mules and wagons and old pickup trucks used by the neighbors who lived on the path. And, of course, the fertilizer truck that came by in the spring, along with an occasional visitor, added to the depth of the ruts. On my walks, like everybody else, I avoided the blossoms gracing the mounds between the ruts and dragged my brogans in the sandy wheel tracks. I was nearly out of breath when I reached Uncle Dewey's house. Dewey Lee was standing in the yard. "Are we really going to cut down the honey tree this morning?" I asked. Looking woeful, Dewey Lee responded, "No, Daddy couldn't find anybody to help him pull the crosscut saw." My feathers flopped, but then I saw that mischievous grin on Dewey Lee's face, and I knew what was going to happen. The honey tree was coming down. Finally, Uncle Dewey, brother, and Hoyt Williams came out of the front porch. "Brother, you get the saw. Dewey Lee, you get the axe. And Tommy, you get the briar blade. Hoyt and I'll get dressed for the job," instructed Uncle Dewey. By getting dressed, he meant putting on 2 pairs of pants, 2 shirts, and high-top shoes, and then tying his pants legs. In those days, no one had ever heard of a bee suit, and certainly not a smoker, which later was used to scatter the bees and counter the bee stings. In our community, there were no beehives. As a matter of fact, I had never heard of a beehive. Can you believe that only 6 years later, I would be in the honey business with more than 10 hives? But that's another story. Uncle Dewey finished tying his pants legs, looked around, and called out, "Everybody ready? Then, let's go." The honey tree was located in the edge of the woods that led to the Cherry Hole, a small body of water that was a favorite place for us to swim, fish, and camp. No one knows why it was called the Cherry Hole, and no one knows how it was formed. It was located a few feet from the run of Sapony Creek, but was never considered a part of the creek. It was simply the Cherry Hole, surrounded by big, tall pine trees of 2 species, Loblolly and Longstraw. As the pine trees grew up toward the sky, the treetops formed a canopy that prevented the sun from reaching the ground, which in turn kept other trees and underbrush from growing, creating a thick rug of pine needles. The sun rays, however, did invade a few spots in the treetops, the warmth permitting the tough little dogwoods to grow, their blooms adding to the beauty of the woods. To me, it was a big chapel, the sweet smell of dogwoods, complete quiet and peace. At the edge of the field, the sun won the battle. There were a few gum trees, a few oaks, wildflowers, and honeysuckle, all protected by thick thorny bushes, underbrush, and briars. Guess where the honey tree was? You guessed it, in the middle of the underbrush and briars. Dewey Lee marveled. "Well, there she is. See that old dead oak? Boy, I bet that tree's 1,000 years old." Uncle Dewey smiled. "Well, I don't think it's quite that old, but it's old." I looked up. "Where's the bees?" "Look at the lower limb," Brother chimed in. The end is broken off, leaving a hollow. See? The bees going in and out? Oh, I see. The bees are really working. I kept my voice low and calm, trying to hide my excitement. Are we going to cut down the whole tree? No, Brother smiled at my ignorance. We'll just saw off the hollow limb with the bees and honey in it. The hollow limb was about 5 feet up and much too high to be sawed off from the ground. Fortunately, Uncle Dewey had foreseen the problem and had already placed short ladders at each side of the tree trunk. Uncle Dewey and Hoyt were ready to ascend the ladders, Hoyt on one side and Uncle Dewey on the other. All right. When this limb hits the ground, the bees will be mad as all fire, so you kids better get away from there as fast as you can, exclaimed Uncle Dewey. Dewey Lee, Brother, and I followed this advice to a certain extent. We were adventurous and curious. We wanted to see the limb fall, so we went about 4 or 5 feet from the tree. Uncle Dewey and Hoyt began sawing, and finally the limb, the home of the bees, hit the ground with a thud. Uncle Dewey and Hoyt dropped the saw and fled the scene. We youngins, as we were often called, being brave, not afraid of danger, and completely ignorant of the true state of events, calmly turned and began to walk slowly away. We had only gone about 3 steps when the angry bees began to fill the air around us. Brother and Dewey Lee ran toward the cherry hole away from danger. I had no sooner turned to follow when a bee found its target, its hot knife stinger stabbing over my right eye. Bees began buzzing in my hair. I panicked. I knew I had to escape the bee, so I headed for the edge of the woods towards the field. The journey took me through briars, low-hanging limbs, and thorny bushes that tore at my clothes and skin, mercifully brushing away the bees. Finally, I broke through to the open field. My right eye had swollen shut. My face and arms were bloody. My grown-up bravery was gone. I was a sobbing 7-year-old again. I stumbled to Uncle Dewey's house. Aunt Lillian was in the yard. My Lord, child, I looked out the window and saw you coming. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew somebody was going to get stung. Come in the house right now. Take off all your clothes except your underwear, Aunt Lily instructed firmly. While I was tearing at my overalls, she opened the pie safe, which held not only the pies when they were cooling, but also other household goods, including home medicines. First, she smeared my head with an Arm & Hammer baking soda paste, and followed that with a railroad snuff paste to my swollen eye. Both remedies concocted by adding a little water to the soda and snuff. Immediate relief, or so I thought. I lay down on the sofa and let her gentle, loving care dry my tears. In about 30 minutes, I felt well enough to go home. My mother, like an old setting hen with her one chick, repeated the snuff and soda process begun by Aunt Lillian. By this time, I was feeling much better. Late that same afternoon, Dewey Lee came walking up the path. Mother, Daddy, and I were sitting on the front porch. Before he got in the yard, I yelled, "What are you doing here? Did they get the honey?" 2 dishpans full, and everybody wants you to come and eat supper with us and spend the night," grinned Dewey Lee. I spun and blurted out, "Can I? Can I, Mother?" Mother looked at Daddy, and his expression showed no objection. "Well," Mother said, "it looks to me like Lillian and Dewey would be tired of you spending the night so much, but I guess this is a special occasion, so go ahead." I jumped off the porch, and Dewey Lee and I started for his house. It was almost dark when he arrived, and Uncle Dewey, Hoyt, and Brother were sitting on the front porch. In those days with no air conditioning, it was too hot to be in the house before the sun went down, unless, of course, you were in charge of preparing supper. Nobody heard of dinner at night. The women and the girls had the hot job of preparing the meal, no matter what the weather. I left Dewey Lee and the others on the porch and went back to the kitchen to tell Aunt Lillian that I was there and was going to spend the night. The old wood stove was throwing off a blanket of heat that caused the sweat to dampen my shirt and burn my eyes, but the smell of middling meat frying in the pan made me tarry. Nothing could beat the smell of that sizzling, lean streak of fat, except, perhaps, the aroma of buttermilk biscuits baking in the oven. I stopped just long enough to hear Aunt Lillian said, "Glad you could come. Now we have the whole gang of honey hunters." As I started back to the porch, I heard everyone laughing. Uncle Dewey was cackling so loud he would occasionally stomp the floor. When I came out, everyone tried to restrain himself but couldn't, and the laughter started again. I shouted, "What on earth's so funny?" Uncle Dewey finally got control, wiped the tears from his eyes, and said, "Hoyt and I saw you running through those briars and bushes like a jackrabbit and slapping at those bees. It scared us at first 'cause we saw you'd been stung. But when you reached the field and were still running, we figured you were okay." What a sight that was! Then everybody started snickering again. I was not embarrassed. Actually, I was pleased to be the center of attention. All of us had been so engrossed in our jabbering about our honey harvest that we hardly noticed that the sun had slipped out of sight behind the trees, leaving us in the dark. Brother sniffed the night air and questioned, "What's that smell?" "We all smell it, son. It's coming from the kitchen, and it makes all of us hungry. I could eat a dead mule," declared Uncle Dewey. Hoyt mumbled, "I think we can all agree with you on that." Everyone got quiet, and with the silence on the porch, I noticed that the bullfrogs down on the creek began to croak, and the crickets' chirping grew louder. All of us were quiet, each thinking his own thoughts. Eileen, Uncle Dewey's oldest daughter, finally came to the front door and announced, "If anybody's hungry, supper's ready." She didn't have to say that but one time. The famished menfolk, we children like to think of ourselves as men, stumbled over one another going through the dark living room on our way to the dining room. The table was set for 6 people, Hoyt and brother on one side, Dewey, Lee, and I on the other, Uncle Dewey at one end and Aunt Lillian at the other. The girls, Eileen, Betty Lou, and Nancy, always had to wait for the second seating, and there wasn't enough room at the table the first time around. The red and white checkered oilcloth was the tablecloth. The white tablecloth was used only on Sunday when the preacher was invited to dinner. An old oil-wick kerosene lamp, the only source of light, decorated the center of the table. In the dim flickers of the lamp, we could see a bowl of rice, a plate of Midland meat, a pan of hot biscuits, and a dishpan brimming full of honeycomb with about 3 inches of pure honey, which had leaked from the comb to the bottom of the pan. Our mouths watered as we anticipated that first bite, but we had to wait for Aunt Lillian's signal to begin. Finally it came. "Dewey, ask the blessing." "Thank the Lord for supper." "Amen," prayed Uncle Dewey fervently, and we all fell to passing the bounty and filling our plates. I was just about to dip my biscuits in the golden succulent fruit of our labors when Uncle Dewey cautioned, "Watch out for the dead bees." I looked down at my plate and was shocked to see 5 or 6 little black bees decorating the honey in my plate. This was a 7-year-old's first encounter with wild honey. Aunt Lillian saw my surprise and told me, "Just rake the bees to the side of your plate. If you eat one, it won't hurt you. As a matter of fact, I heard bees may be good for you," Uncle Dewey added. Aunt Lillian cut in, "Don't be telling him such nonsense." "No, really. I heard eating bees may be good for you. Who knows? Uncle Dewey, ahead of his time, could have heard something about protein." Anyway, along with the others, I raked the dead bees from the honey to the side of my plate and said, "Pass the biscuits." We all ate with relish, and when we had finally finished, we pushed back our chairs, sighing with contentment. It wasn't long before we again began congratulating ourselves on our superior honey harvest. And of course, Uncle Dewey reiterated his tale of me running through the briars like a jackrabbit. Aunt Lillian interrupted him, saying, "I heard you on the porch teasing Tommy." "Well, Dewey, I didn't hear you talking about you running through the briars. You must have done something to tear your pants all to pieces. I'm glad you had on 2 pairs of pants. If you hadn't, you'd have been naked." And by the way, how did you get the briar scratch on the left side of your face? I really don't think you could have run like a jackrabbit, but you certainly must have walked mighty fast. I knew she was trying to take up from me, but it wasn't necessary. I was still enjoying the notoriety. Everyone was quiet, waiting for Uncle Dewey's reaction. A minute passed as he studied the situation, but then Uncle Dewey burst out laughing, and everybody joined in. Finally, Hoyt said, "I certainly enjoyed the supper, the day, and everything, and I'd like to stay longer, but I need to get home." He left, and pretty soon we all piled onto beds, if we could find an empty one, or pallets spread out on any available floor space. Soon we were sleeping soundly. I really don't believe I could do that now. The day of the honey tree was history, and sadly the day of the wild honeybee in my area is history. There are no hollow limbs on stately oak trees, no homes for the bees where timber companies have clear-cut, and two-story houses stand where the honeybees used to buzz. In addition, diseases and insects have almost destroyed the wild honeybee and are now invading the hives of the domesticated bees. Beekeepers and scientists are working to find ways to save these busy creatures which pollinate our food supply. But there is one certainty. The memory of the day of the honey tree will live with me forever. Chapter 5, Dean School. Before I knew it, the summer of 1934 had passed, and the month that all of us children hated was upon us. You guessed it, right? September. It was a time for us to consent to being confined in what we called prison, the schoolhouse. You will recall that I attended first grade in Nashville. Moving back to the home place entitled me to go to Dean School with my friends. An improvement. Or so I thought. Daddy knew better. What a surprise was in store for me. My buddy, Alan Cooper, still lived on Evans Road, which was not far from my new home on the path. He, Dewey Lee, brother, the whole gang, and I played together. But this was the first time since I moved back home that I was to join them at school. The first day. On the first day of school, I learned something about real country folks and their schooling. We arrived so early that first morning that the schoolhouse was still locked. There were several other children already there in the schoolyard. I had previously been told that my second grade teacher was Miss Deanny Card, who I secretly hoped would be as nice as Mrs. White, my first grade teacher. Feeling a little tug on my overalls, I turned around to find little Creech Whitley. He eagerly looked up at me and said, "I'm going to school, too. I'll be in the first grade." Creech looked a little nervous. He lived around the V near my Aunt Nettie. The V, now named Rose Loop Road, formed a half-circle beginning and ending on Old Bailey Highway. I've always wondered why we didn't call it the U. Creech wasn't a stranger, but because he was younger, he wasn't in my close circle of friends. This morning, he had a fresh haircut, one that our community called a bowl cut. A bowl was actually placed on your head, and your hair was trimmed around up to the edges of the bowl, leaving a mop of hair on top. This was the only cut large families could afford, but being an only child, I got my haircuts from the Nashville barbers, Lonnie Brake or Chinaman Farrell. I never knew Chinaman's real name. Having a neat haircut was a priority with my daddy. Even after I was a grown man, he would offer me money if you can't afford to get a haircut. In spite of the hot September weather, Creech wore a ragged sweater with his sleeves so long they flapped at the end of the fingers. His overalls were ragged. The knees and the seat of the pants had holes dotted here and there. Not that we were without patches, but little Creech looked like a rag doll. Feeling a little sorry for him, I said, "Creech, who's your teacher?" He quickly responded, "Miss Card." Not wanting him to feel bad, I gently questioned, "Are you sure?" "I thought she was my teacher." "Nah, she's mine," retorted Creech. "Okay," I answered. And I just left it there, understanding that Creech, being a first grader, probably didn't know. I went back to Alan and Dewey Lee standing nearby. Alan asked, "Where you been?" "Over talking to the little Whitley boy, poor fellow. He doesn't even know who his first grade teacher is. He thinks it's Miss Card."
"It is," said Alan.
"Is what?"
"Yes, Miss Card is his first grade teacher," shouted Alan, no doubt thinking I was beginning to lose my hearing.
"Well, my friend, who was our second grade teacher?" I angrily retorted.
"Why, Miss Card."
I was dumbfounded. Was someone playing a trick on me? I turned to Joyce Ayers, who had just walked up and who was, I knew, in the third grade. Laughing sarcastically, I asked, "Who's your teacher, Joyce?"
"Miss Card."
Without cracking a smile, she looked at me strangely and responded,
"Yes."
3 shocks in a row. One teacher for grades 1, 2, and 3? But believe me, I had more shocks to come. Scratching my head, standing there in the schoolyard, I pondered the one-teacher-three-grade situation. How on earth is Miss Card going to handle teaching 3 grades at once? If she puts each grade in a room, will she run back and forth from room to room? When she leaves a room, who will keep us quiet? Finally, the school door opened and everybody trooped in. There was no bell at Dean's school. Some students went in one room, and I followed Dewey Lee and Alan in the other room. I noticed that Brother didn't go with us. He went to the first room. He was in the fourth grade. As I walked in, I noticed that little Creech and Joyce were already there. Well, I said to myself, we haven't been separated yet. All of a sudden, everybody got quiet. I turned. There stood a young woman with jet-black hair and brownish-green eyes. Her long, pale blue dress, which hung about 6 inches from the floor and clung delicately to her slender frame, made her look taller than she probably was. I thought she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I leaned over my desk as far as I could, trying to look around to see if Miss Card was in sight. At that instant, I heard Joyce Ayers, who was sitting in her front desk, softly say, "Good morning, Miss Card." I was in a state of shock. Well, I thought, she certainly doesn't look like Miss White. Not to say that I didn't like Miss White. I loved her. She was a motherly type. I was soon to learn that Miss Card really wasn't the motherly type. Alan, Dewey Lee, and a boy who lived around the V, Roger Cockrell, had been playing marbles outside. They were now in the back of the room arguing about who had won which marble. They were yelling at each other and were so engrossed in their argument that they did not see Miss Card enter the room. She walked to her desk and turned to the blackboard, then turned again to the classroom, pointing at each of us with a yardstick that she had retrieved from the little chalk shelf that ran along the bottom of the blackboard. All this seemed to happen in slow motion, but not for long. Suddenly, she raised the yardstick over her head and slammed it flat surface on the wooden desk. It sounded like a shotgun blast. The brown had faded from Miss Card's brownish-green eyes. Alan, Dewey Lee, and Roger scrambled for the nearest desks. Miss Card walked around in front of her desk. Her icy green eyes pierced each of us in turn, and with a voice suddenly encased in steel, she said, "There will be order in this classroom. There will be no scuffling, fights, or loud noise. You will, I say will, act like ladies and gentlemen. I do not intend to spend my time on disciplinary problems. Have I made myself clear? Are there any questions?" Needless to say, there were none. I was numb with fear. I had never heard Mrs. White talk that way. A few minutes
pass with complete silence in a classroom until Miss Card continued. "Now, students, I know you think I'm a mean person, but I'm not. I love children, and I love teaching. But no teacher can teach anybody anything in a rowdy schoolroom, particularly when you have to teach three grades at once in one room. You deserve better, and I hope that the Nash County Board of Education will someday realize it." Good Lord, teaching the first, second, and third grades in one room. How can she do it, I thought. Then I began to understand that it was a necessity for a teacher to maintain discipline in a classroom. I was no longer afraid of her. I fell in love with her all over again. Throughout my whole school life, I never forgot this lesson. I guess this is one of the reasons I never gave any of my teachers any trouble. Of course, the fact that my mother told my teacher, "If you have to whip him, just let me know and I'll whip him again when he gets home," might have had something to do with my good behavior. As a matter of fact, I admired all my teachers, some more than others, of course. But not everyone agreed with me about Miss Card declaring that she was just too bossy. "All right," Miss Card began. "I want to welcome all of you back to school, and a special welcome to you first graders. How does it feel to be grown up and in school just like other children?" I could visualize the little ones sticking their chests out with pride, she continued. "And I would like to introduce Tommy Cooper, who last year completed the first grade in Nashville Elementary School. We welcome you, Tommy. Please stand up." I was shocked again. I stood up so quickly that I hit my pencil against my desk, causing it to sprint across the floor. Thanks to Miss Card's great discipline, nobody giggled. With all the ups and downs, new people, new school, excitement, shocks, and new teacher, my emotions were in turmoil. After being introduced, I sat down at my desk and began to feel a little better, but disaster waited. I had a pressing need to go to the bathroom. I wiggled around trying to alleviate the uncomfortable urge, but to no avail. I prayed that someone in the classroom would raise their hand and ask to be excused, but no one did. Finally, my bladder conquered my embarrassment. I slowly raised my hand. Miss Card looked at me questioningly. "Yes?" I blurted out, "May I go to the bathroom?" Miss Card recognized my unease, smiled, and gently said what I had prayed for her to say, "Yes, you may." I meekly arose from my desk and quickly went out of the room and into the hall. "Where's the bathroom?" More specifically, "Where's the boys' bathroom?" I asked myself. I looked up and down the short hall. There were five doors. The first led to my room. The next door I knew led to the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade room. The third door led to the outside. The fourth and fifth doors were close together near the outside door. Hooray! One for girls and one for boys, I rejoiced. By this time, a real emergency existed. I rushed toward the doors. Which one was the boys' bathroom? There were no signs on either door. In a frenzy, I grabbed the doorknob to the door on the right and jerked it open. Did my eyes deceive me? There in front of me were mops, brooms, stacked boxes, a storage closet. Leaving this door slammed against the wall, I rushed to door number 5 and, panic filling my heart, again grabbed the doorknob and jerked the door open. No! Mops, brooms, stacked boxes, another storage closet. By this time, horror invaded my body. I simply had to go to the bathroom. I stifled a sob. "You stupid idiot," I said to myself. "Go outside!" As I turned to run, the fourth, fifth, sixth grade room door opened, and out walked a fifth grade student whose name I later learned was Bruce Tyson. He looked at me with a startled stare and asked, "What on earth's the matter with you?" The bathroom, I gotta go real bad," I sobbed. "Well, what in the world are you doing here in the hall?" Hurry up and come with me, replied Bruce. He took me by the hand and ran so fast that I was like a sheet hanging in the wind. We, or should I say he, ran back behind the schoolhouse along a narrow path that led through a few pine trees to a small, wooden, rectangular structure situated over a hole in the ground. The boys' bathroom. I flung open the door. I believe I actually flew inside. Words cannot describe my relief. I clasped both hands together, placed them under my chin, tilted my head back, and uttered, "Thank you, Lord. Thank you." And this time, I really, really mean it. Bruce, almost out of breath, observed, "You must be the new boy. Welcome to Dean's school." "Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You're my friend forever. I'll never ask you for anything, and if I can ever help you, I will. But, Bruce, there's one more thing. Will you promise me you'll never tell anyone about this?" Bruce smiled and said, "I promise." I later heard that Bruce, when asked, "Have you met Tommy?" replied, "Yes. When I met him, he asked me to race him to the bathroom, and, you know, the little scutter won." He had altered the story just enough to keep his promise. Many years later, I heard that Bruce had graduated from the University of Virginia, majoring in pharmacy, and that he had a job working for a drugstore in Richmond. Every time I think of him, I think of our race to the bathroom and his promise not to tell. The rest of the day passed without incident, and I settled into the routine of a new school. Extracurricular. After my bathroom learning experience, I became more confident and comfortable at my new school, but there were still some things that I had to get used to. There were no basketball hoops or basketballs, no slides, swings, or other exercise equipment. The baseball field was a small broom straw field. We never played baseball, but we did play a game called Straight Cat. To play this game, we were supposed to have a baseball, but we didn't have one. Instead, we used a ball made by winding tobacco twine into a round, soft ball. Tobacco twine was a string we used to tie tobacco leaves to the sticks that were hung in a tobacco barn to cure. To make the ball a little harder, we wrapped tape around it, if, of course, we could find any tape. The players of the game consisted of the pitcher, the catcher, the batter, and as many fielders as came to play. There were only two bases, the pitcher's mound and home plate, where the catcher was located. If the pitcher struck the batter out or threw him out before he could run to the pitcher's mound and back to home plate, then the batter was out. In that case, the batter became the pitcher, and the pitcher took the batter's place. If the batter hit the ball to a fielder who caught the ball or threw the ball to the catcher before the hitter could run to the pitcher's mound and back to home plate, the batter was out, and the batter took the fielder's place so that the fielder could become the next batter. Whenever the batter hit the ball and was able to run to the pitcher's mound and back to home plate without being thrown out, the batter got to hit again for as long as he could continue to be successful. I can't remember anybody keeping score. It was enough to be able to continue batting. Straight Cat was played mostly by fifth and sixth graders, but anybody could play, and I did. I never saw a girl playing Straight Cat. Their games were hide-and-seek, hopscotch, jump rope, and jack rocks. We boys didn't stick to Straight Cat. We played marbles, stick frog, and sometimes we even joined the girls for a round of hide-and-seek. Stick frog, a game played with pocket knives, was one of my favorites. When I was young, every boy I knew had at least one pocket knife, which was a small knife with blades that folded into the handle. I had three or four, thanks to Santa Claus, who always had an unlimited supply in his sleigh at Christmas. Although kids sometimes fought on the school ground, I never heard of anyone getting cut or even using a knife in a fight, and there was no school rule against carrying a pocket knife. The object of Stick Frog was to get your knife to stick in the ground a certain number of times using various increasingly difficult methods. A failure at any point disqualified the player. The last man standing was, of course, the winner. First, the player stood up, took the blade between the forefinger and thumb, and flipped it into the ground 3 times, making it stick each time. Those who survived the first round went on to round 2. Next, the player held the knife by the blade point, just under the nose, with the head tilted forward. After nodding the head up and down several times, the player flipped the knife, sticking the point in the ground. This feat, once again, had to be accomplished 3 times. Next, the successful player formed a hole by holding the forefinger and thumb together and then dropping the knife through the hole 3 times. If the knife stuck each time, the player could then move on to another, more difficult position called jumping the fence. He placed one hand vertically on the ground like a small fence, placed the handle in his other hand, and tried to flip the knife over the fence. Anyone who could stick the knife 3 times in this position deserved to be the winner. As to the name of this game, I have no idea how the frog got in Stick Frog. I know that many of the teachers remember how to play these games, but my grandchildren probably never heard of them. Since my dean's school experience took place in the 1934 Depression year, we had to figure out ways to amuse ourselves that didn't cost much. One day at lunchtime recess, Alan, Roger, and I strolled over to where Dewey Lee, brother, and James Rackley were crouched on the ground in a circle, about to start a game of marbles. Dewey Lee shouted out, "Y'all come on over. We're about to start the game." They had already drawn a circle in the dirt. James said, "Hey, since we have 6 players, let's just put 2 marbles each in the ring. That'll make 12 marbles in all. Come on, you guys. Ante up. Let's go." Roger complained, "You and Dewey Lee are the best marble shooters in the school." Alan piped up, "Well, come on. What the heck? It'll be just 2 marbles you can lose." Alan and I dropped in 2 marbles. Roger fumbled in his pockets and finally dropped his 2 marbles in. Dewey Lee marked a straight line in the dirt, then took 9 steps and marked another line. All of us knew that we would toe the first line and toss our marbles as close as we could to the other line. The marble closest to the line would get the first shot, and so on down the line. If there was a tie, of course, they would toss again and break the tie. The order of the shots thus determined, the game began. Dewey Lee, of course, earned the first shot. Roger yelled, "See what I tell you? You can't even beat him tossing closest to the line." Dewey Lee looked up and with a deep sigh retorted, "It was just luck." "Nah, it won't. Go ahead and shoot," Roger answered back. We all got down on our knees around the first ring. Dewey Lee had his big marble called the log cart ready for the first shot, laying his right hand on the ground and smoothly and expertly closing his hand over the log cart so that it could roll between his thumb and index finger. Tension built. All eyes were fixed on Dewey Lee's hand when the big glass sphere exploded into the group of marbles we had placed in the ring. One of them rolled quickly out of the ring while the log cart stuck right in place, as Dewey Lee had intended. When that happened, the shooter got another go and could continue until his log cart, too, rolled out of the ring. Dewey Lee won 3 marbles before any of the rest of us could even have a chance to shoot. After a lot of shooting and yelling, the game ended. Dewey Lee had 8 of the 12 marbles. Poor Roger lost both of his marbles, and so did I. Roger was right after all. We played for keeps. The marbles you won were yours. My mother never knew this. To her, that would have been gambling and, therefore, a sin. Needless to say, I did not enlighten her. Before we knew it, the warmth of the sunny fall days had evaporated into the chill of old man winter. Our outside games were greatly diminished, and, of course, we had no inside gyms. I remember the cold mornings, the ground frozen hard, frost sprinkled on the dead grass, and ice in the schoolyard mud holes. We stood around, blowing our hot breath into our hands to keep them warm, turning up our coat collars and snapping the ear flaps on our Lindbergh caps to keep out the frigid air, waiting for the school door to open. When it did, we rushed in to stand around the old coal-burning stoves, pushing slightly for our spot in the welcome warmth. There were no radiators that were placed around the room to spread the heat like we had had back in Nashville school. The best I can remember, there were two stoves at Dean's, one in the first, second, third grade room, and one in the fourth, fifth, sixth grade room. Each stove was placed on a thick layer of dirt, which was enclosed in a square made of boards about 8 inches high. If a hot coal fell out of the stove, it would fall harmlessly into the dirt. These stoves, fed by coal, would get red hot. Our teachers were always admonishing us not to get too close or our clothes might catch on fire. I do not remember ever seeing a janitor at the school. I do remember that the boys in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade room were assigned the task of bringing in the coal from the coal pile outside. On occasion, these boys actually started the fire in the stove, but most of the time it was the job of the teachers. Sometimes our overburdened teachers had this task done for them by Mr. John Deans, who lived about 100 yards across the road from the school. He would have made a fine PTA president had there been such a thing then. As a matter of fact, the following summer, Mr. Deans, my daddy, and some other community leaders petitioned the Nash County Board of Education to consolidate Deans School with Nashville Elementary School. After hearing an effective litany of three grades in one room from one teacher, no equipment, coal-burning stoves, and so on, the board agreed. I'll never forget John Dean standing at the well with Daddy and me drawing water. He had a grin on his face. "Roy," he said, "we did it. The board accepted our petition. The kids are going to Nashville School next year." Perhaps that was one of the sparks for my interest in politics. By working together and convincing government leaders, you can make a difference in people's lives. This is just as true today as it was then. Although all of us were excited about attending Nashville School, none of us ever forgot the friendships we formed at Dean's School. J.H. Dean, one of John Dean's children, became a hospital administrator in Winston-Salem. Whenever he visited Nashville, he would stop by my office, and we would always end up talking about old times and our life at Dean's School. Roger Cockrell, Alan Cooper, and I became known as the Three Musketeers. We were always together throughout school, graduated from high school together, and went to Oak Ridge Military Academy together. Roger then split and went to Chapel Hill, but Alan and I spent our college life at Wake Forest. Miss Card would have been proud. Chapter 6, Neighborhood Parties. Growing up in the 1920s and 1930s, the Depression years, was a difficult time for the entire country, but it was particularly hard for country folks. There were big families, much work to be done, and little money to buy food or clothes or to hire anyone to help with the farming chores. Of course, welfare was available, but in my neck of the woods, farm families were a proud people, too proud to accept help from the government. In fact, people thought that the worst insult one child could fling at another was, "Your mama's on welfare." Our neighborhoods were innovative. If a task was too difficult for one family to tackle alone, they simply invited the whole neighborhood over for a party, and everyone, even the children, pitched in. The work got done, and, as they say, a good time was had by all. We had hog killings, sawings, and corn shuckings, to name a few. As I look back over my childhood memories, I realized what an exciting part of my life these gatherings were. Chapter 7, Cracklins and Sweet Potatoes. I peeped out the back door. The night was pitch black. The stars were so bright you could see them twinkle. The ground was frozen solid. I was excited, maybe more excited than I was at Christmas a month before. In my bare feet and long underwear, I skipped through the kitchen on the cold linoleum to the warm sitting room where the little tin heater was red hot, puffing like a train. Daddy and Mother were sitting in their rocking chairs by the heater. I could hardly contain my enthusiasm. "It's fair and cold," I nearly shouted, knowing that's the kind of weather we needed. Daddy looked up from reading the Progressive Farmer and said with a half-smile, "I reckon the hog killing's on." "Time to go to bed," Mother added. "It's past 8 o'clock." I jumped up to open the door to the freezing bedroom and skipped back across the linoleum floor, dived onto the bottomless feather bed, and sank so deeply that only my nose stuck out. Tomorrow was hog killing day. It was Saturday and no school. My parents would never let me miss a day of school. All the neighbors would come. I could hardly wait for morning. It seemed the minute I closed my eyes, our old Rhode Island red rooster sounded his regular morning alarm with a screeching, "Urk, urk, urk." I looked over at Mom and Daddy's bed. We were back to one bedroom at the home place. Of course, they were already up. I bounded out of bed and ran into the dining sitting room to find the old heater red hot and the wonderful smell of country ham permeating the house. I pulled on a wool shirt and, of course, long underwear and soft, thick socks. Next, I stepped into my overalls. We had never heard the word dungarees or jeans. It took just a minute to tie the laces to my worn but comfortable brogans, and I was ready for the hog killing. In the kitchen, I found the dipper in the old wooden water bucket frozen tight in the ice, another sign that it really was hog-killing time. After a hearty breakfast of country ham, hot biscuits, red-eye gravy, and molasses, Daddy and I were off to make sure the hogs were in their fattening pen, where limited space and heavy feeding made the meat tender and the extra fat made more lard for cooking. Next, we made sure the water was in the vat, a rectangular wooden box lined with tin. After filling the vat with water, we started a fire in a hole under the vat. The water had to be very hot to facilitate the dehairing of the dead hog. Not a pretty picture, but necessary for clean hog meat. The wash pot was next, and by the time we had filled the pot with water and built a fire around it, Uncle Brad, Uncle Bob, Uncle Joad, a man we called Uncle Captain, and the rest of the neighbors began to arrive. Most of the men in the community were called Uncle, as you notice. The women were called Aunt. Why some men rated Mister, I have no idea. The women headed for the kitchen, and the men gathered around the fires at the wash pot and vat, traded jokes and warming their icy hands. Uncle Brad, of course, was purposefully sharpening his favorite butcher knife, holding it with his right hand and with his left sweeping it back and forth on the wet rock, which was a small slate rock used for sharpening. He was the one who gutted the hogs. "Well," said Daddy, "let's get to it." Off we went to the hog pen. I ran on ahead to get old Mary, our mule. I had already harnessed her to the slide truck, which would be used to transport the dead hog, the first of three. But I ran on ahead so that I could get to the pen before the kill, in spite of instructions to arrive with Mary after the kill. Uncle Joad was already aiming his .22 rifle, and Mr. Van, one of the few men in the community I called Mr., I don't know why, was holding a sharp knife, standing in the pen waiting for the kill. We have to leave the story for now, but we will continue next broadcast with some more of Between the Creeks by Roy A. Cooper, Jr. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience and is being made in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Thank you for listening in to The Bookshelf.